again, everybody. I'm Rick Sanchez. This is Direct Impact, and this is what we're going to be talking about.
To end this conflict in a way that is durable and lasting, that doesn't ensure that Israel is fighting another war against the Palestinian people.
Did you hear it? You just heard the spokesperson for the U.S. State Department accidentally tell the truth. I'm Rick Sanchez. Let's do this. All right, so let's get started. Something really fascinating happened yesterday at the U.S. State Department. The PR guy, right? The guy who works there, who reporters often accuse of being a bit of a bold-faced liar regarding U.S. foreign policy. Then again, I guess that's his job, right? Well, he accidentally told the truth yesterday. It just kind of slipped out of his mouth, I guess, when he was being honest, when he said this.
To end this conflict in a way that is durable and lasting, that doesn't ensure that Israel is fighting another war against the Palestinian people in 3 months or 6 months or even a year or 2 years, and in a way that provides real security for Palestinians and Israelis alike.
Did you hear that? I don't know if you heard it because it was stuck in the middle of it. So let's do this. I'm going to pull it out and have our guys over here play that for you again. Here, listen now.
To end this conflict in a way that is durable and lasting, that doesn't ensure that Israel is fighting another war against the Palestinian people.
A war with the Palestinian people. He just said Israel is at war with the Palestinian people. Did he say that because that's what he really thinks? Because when he's in private and not in front of a bunch of reporters, when he's not being paid to try and sway what they think, that's what he really says? By the way, when a reporter tells Miller, that's Matthew Miller, that what he just did, what he just said, he said, oops, that's not what I meant. Thank you for correcting me. In fact, it was exactly what he meant, because that is the truth. Let me help you here. In 2005, Israel told all non-Palestinians who were settlers living in Gaza. Yes, Gaza used to have Israelis and Palestinians living together. Israel and Middle East scholars say they did that. They asked all the Israeli citizens who were living there to get out. They told all the settlers to get out. You know why they did that? So that they could turn Gaza into a fully occupied country. They couldn't do those with Israelis living there, you know? So since then, Palestinians in Gaza have been forced to live in horrendous and brutal conditions once they got the good guys out, where every couple of years the IDF goes in and, quote, mows them down, mows the lawn. That's what they've said, though, their words. Well, since the deplorable attack on Israel on October 7th, Israel has killed 36,000 Palestinians. Not 36,000 members of Hamas, 36,000 Palestinians. And more than 10,000 of them are children. So let me repeat, when Matt Miller accidentally told the truth, that's exactly what he meant, that Israel is at war with the Palestinian people, Manila.
Yeah, Rick, I mean, so Matt Miller, we know he's a paid propagandist, right? So the question is this a Freudian slip, you know, revealing the true unconscious thought, or just simply a flub, Rick? I mean, I'm no fan of Matt Miller ever since back in his MSNBC contributor days during the Trump years. Well, I believe that this onslaught on Gaza is exactly that, a deliberate attack on civilians. But to be fair, I will cut him a little slack here, Rick, on some flubs here and there. When you speak for a living, Rick, you and I both know this. These flubs happen to everyone, but the difference is that most people aren't in front of cameras to catch them saying it or in front of a room full of reporters. And now that said, we heard Matt Lee of the AP. He's a legend in that State Department press room. I've been around him. Very fair, always on it. He called out Matt Miller on that flub, forced him to defend his position on Gaza. And that's exactly the right thing to do as a reporter. Right? There's no way
I'm going to give them some props here. When you watch those State Department briefings, you get more news out of that, not just from what is said, but also from what is not said and just asked, than you would from any newscast on MSNBC, Fox, CNN, the New York Times, all combined.
because they actually do have some interesting exchanges there. I agree with you. My point about Matt Miller saying this, whether he meant to say it, whether it was a mistake, whether we should forgive him, whatever, what he actually said was the truth. Israel is at war with the Palestinian people. 36,000 members of Hamas have not been killed. 36,000 Palestinians have been killed.
Right, Rick. I mean, there is no way for any of us to know exactly what's in Matt Miller's head or in his heart.
Yeah.
And maybe it is our personal bias, but for me, I'm going with the flub on this one. I'm going with the Freudian slip. I know it was a flub, but it's the Freudian slip. And the State Department spokesman knows full well, because like you said, the numbers bear that out.
Of course.
So I think the evidence is just in the numbers alone.
You're saying deep down in the recesses of his mind, his brain, he probably believes that, and that's maybe why it slipped. That's fair. I get it. And we can disagree on that. All right, let's talk about something else. The election results in India. This is fascinating. They're in, and the media got it wrong. The vast majority of the journalistic community all over the world, including me, this guy right here, I told you that Prime Minister Modi would win. I even went as far as to say, do you remember, did you watch this show that I did on this? I went as far as to say that he was almost universally beloved, and he would win this thing in a landslide. I was so wrong. And the people of India, all 600 million of them who cast ballots, told me so. Modi's party, by the way, can you believe that? 600 million people voted? 600 million. Modi's party that usually gets enough votes to govern parliament without having to form a coalition did not win enough votes this time around. Technically, it's still a win, and he will lead the country, but there's no question that the Indian people, no question, I think, They're sending him a message, as his opponent
said. The main thing that this election has said, the country has unanimously and clearly stated, we do not want Mr. Narendra Modi and Mr. Amit Shah to be involved in the running of this country. We do not like the way they have run this country.
That is the head of the opposition party, India's opposite, Rahul Gandhi, basking and blasting at the same time. So, I mean, what do you think, Manila? Here's the question. What made so many people who in the past have loved this guy, cherished this guy, voted for this guy, Modi, suddenly turn against him?
Well, look, Rick, I appreciate you being humble and saying you got it wrong, but you didn't actually get this totally wrong. So first, let's point out that India is the largest democracy on earth. The staggering 6-week election process took this long to finally get through 640 million votes that were cast. This is Modi's, actually his historic third term win as prime minister. His Hindu-based BJP party and their allies, known collectively, they're called the NDA, they won 293 seats, which is far short of that landslide they were expecting of 400 seats. The collective coalition, also known as the India, they won 234. So the total seats for grabs was 543, Rick. So we know that Modi is a nationalist. He's known as a strongman. The BJP, they did secure a commanding majority in this election, but their popularity has declined since 2019 elections. Back then, the BJP secured 303 seats. They were expecting 400 this time, but the polls seem to indicate that the slide is due to younger Indian voters voting in the other direction.
Yeah, he was a bit of a hardliner and was perceived that way by many, and I think that may have caught up with him. But like you said, he still won. It's just that he used to win like this, and now he's winning
bigly.
Like this. Exactly. And that's
bigly, as Trump would say.
He used to win bigly. Now he wins littly. All right. 80 years after it happened, European leaders have gathered in Normandy to commemorate the defeat of Nazi Germany. The allies who defeated the Nazis, as we know, were principally the Russians, the Americans, and the Brits. So who was invited? The Americans, the French, the Brits, and not the Russians. Though they did by far most of the heavy lifting in that war. And who else was invited, by the way? This guy. Watch this. Look. He's on that plane. You're about to see him get off, regardless of whatever differences may exist between Washington and Moscow, and there are plenty. Not inviting Russia is both dishonest and petty, but inviting this non-elected leader of Ukraine seems even worse. You know why? Because Ukraine had and continues to have, to this day, a real record of supporting Nazis. Everything I'm about to tell you, by the way, sadly, is historical fact that you could find anywhere. Just Google it. When German troops marched into Ukraine in 1941, they were welcomed with Heil Hitler banners. Soon after, 34,000 Jews were rounded up, marched into the fields, and slaughtered. This was done by Ukrainians, while Russians at the time, who were not invited to Normandy, were fighting the Nazis and eventually defeating them. So fine, you're going to probably look at me and say, okay, Sanchez, that's fine. But that was a long time ago. Right? Wrong. Today, many of Ukraine's military units still adorn themselves, right, with Nazi emblems, logos, and symbols on their uniforms. They march to the tune of white nationalists and neo-Nazi chants. But there's more. I'm not done. In recent years, Ukraine has erected a glut of statues honoring Ukrainian Nazis who helped kill the Jews during World War II. The most famous of all of them is this guy named Steve Bandera. Look him up. Steven Bandera is his name, or Stefan, whatever, who, according to a recent report on NBC News, has now more than a dozen monuments glorifying him in Kyiv, Ukraine. Those are just facts. It's a funny way of commemorating Normandy, as far as I'm concerned, Manila.
Yeah, Rick, this is yet another effort to rewrite history, to obfuscate the truth. The Soviets lost some 27 million people in this fight. This shows that we are right back where we were 40 years ago, when in 1984, at the height of the Cold War, Ronald Reagan attended the first major D-Day commemoration in France. At that time, no Soviet leader was present for that as well. And then we look at the hypocrisy. Olaf Scholz was there representing Germany. Yeah. In case we've forgotten, the world was at war against Germany. Hello. Not to mention, like you said, Ukraine's western flank was full of Nazi collaborators, but then there's Zelensky. And the collective West seems to be doing its darndest to prevent any sort of diplomacy. Yeah. And God forbid there be an appearance of an olive branch extended to Russia, because, Rick, you can't continue a war if you act remotely civil and honor a shared history.
Yeah, no, look, you can dislike Russia. It's certainly within your means to do so. You can dislike President Putin. You can dislike Trump. You can dislike us. You could dislike any government. But there's a difference between not liking somebody and not giving someone their due. And I think what's really petty about this, in many ways, you mentioned it, the negating history. The saying, oh, it didn't happen because I don't like that person or that country anymore. It seems childish, it seems petty, and it strips away of the credibility of people like at the State Department and this particular administration, when past administrations have never gone that far or been that petty, my opinion. But here we are. Thank you, Manila. We appreciate it. When we come back, we're going to discuss Lebanon. This is important. Look, all this attention on Gaza, but what about Lebanon? What's going on there? Is that next? Political commentator and journalist Leila Hatoum will join us from Lebanon. There she is. We're having some problems, we should warn, because as we speak, Israel is jamming signals in the area where she is. Might have some technical gifts, but you know what? We're going to do this. We'll be right back. Stay with us.
What is Bharat? Is it a travel ad? Is it a Bollywood poster? Is it the deepest yoga center in the world? Or is it something deeper, more complex, multifaceted? Let's talk without cliches. Let's talk Bharat.
On March the 22nd, 1943, During the Great Patriotic War, the Schutzenmannschaft Battalion 118 burned down the Belarusian village of Khatyn.
Мы на улице играли, а потом пришли, победили, вышли на улицу и начали стрелять. Как начали стрелять, так у нас тут это кругом пули летели.
149 people died, including 75 children. The village was practically wiped off the face of the earth.
Пламя было, зарево было. Очень кричали, плакали. Но люди были порасползавшие. Вот, горело. А живые там никто не остался.
The infamous battalion responsible for the atrocity included over 100 Ukrainian nationalists from Western Ukraine.
И когда я прочитал и увидел, что это были украинцы, и там все были украинцы и по рождению, и по национальности, я спросил у нее, а почему нам об этом не рассказывают нигде никогда?
Declassified criminal cases from the Central Archive of the KGB of Belarus shed light on the atrocity and answer numerous questions that have remained unanswered for many years. Watch on RT.
Truths seem wrong, when old rules just don't hold, and a new world is yet to shape out, disdain becomes the etiquette, and engagement equals betrayal. When so many find themselves worlds apart, we choose to look for common ground.
Welcome back. I'm Rick Sanchez on this passionate day with so much news. You know, with all the attention recently on Gaza, that everybody seems to be paying attention to, obviously, and for good reason, many have failed to see what's happening right now in Lebanon, which may end up being as important, maybe even more so at some point. I want you to take a look at what's going on there right now. You see that video that you're looking at right there, that bombing, that shelling, shows Israelis targeting and bombing areas of southern Lebanon. It is a part of the fighting that has been taking place now for weeks now, or has intensified. To hear the Israelis, they've been doing it for almost 8 months now, but just lately it's been worse. They're trying to attack Hezbollah. Now, it's intensifying to a level where Netanyahu is now saying that he's prepared for another upcoming operation. Another Gaza, perhaps? Leila Hatoum is the editor-in-chief of Menu Uncensored, and she is good enough to join us now from Lebanon. Leila, thank you so much for joining us. How are things there right now?
Well, currently in the eastern sector where I'm based at the moment, it's relatively calm after basically some intensive bombing earlier this morning and in the afternoon. The western and the central sectors are the ones that got most of the hits, especially Ayat Tarun at one point or another. But these are towns most of your viewers, they don't know. They have to go and Google it. What I can say is, as of last night, after midnight, the Israelis didn't dare to actually use their warplanes that much today, as opposed to the previous weeks, because Hezbollah used for the first time its air defense systems to quell Israeli planes who were trying to actually break the sound barrier over the Eastern District, and they actually pushed them out of the Lebanese sovereign airspace. And that constituted another escalation and a new step in the fight that has been ongoing for the past 8 months.
I have so many questions for you, but let me just start with this, because people are watching us from all over the world, and they're trying to figure out, since this conflict between Israel and Lebanon has really been going on since 1982, and it's gotten stronger and then weaker and then stronger, and it stops and it starts. What makes these particular last 8 weeks or months different? Why do we need to pay more attention now?
Okay, if you just may allow me, Lebanon's fight with the Israeli occupation forces has been ongoing since 1949 when we signed the armistice agreement with Israel. And Lebanon was the only country that actually honored its armistice agreement with the Israelis since 1949. The Israelis breached it in 1967 when they attacked Lebanon, which had no hand in the Arab-Israeli conflict at the time, including the Israeli generals actually said that, including Niko Peled's father, who was the general leading that war. In 1978, they invaded Lebanon for the first time, and then they invaded Lebanon again in 1982. The fight between Hezbollah and the Israelis started around 1982 to 1983. However, before that, there was a major fight between all of the Lebanese resistance factions against the Israelis. What makes it special now, since October 8 until now, is basically that the Lebanese resistance, not only Hezbollah, we have six or seven factions now fighting in South Lebanon. They're all Lebanese, except for two factions that are Palestinians helping them out to support what's happening in Gaza. So they're drawing attention away from Gaza, and they're trying to deplete the Israeli forces out of their basically arms stocks and basically their energy. And they have succeeded so far in doing so. The reason is that the Israelis fear Hezbollah and the Lebanese front more than any other front because they are the most trained. They have strategic weapons that not like basically other fronts they don't have. So now we have air defense systems, and this was a shock to the Israelis as well. For the past 7 weeks, this has escalated because of the kind of weapons that Hezbollah had been introducing. It was actually the Lebanese resistance that was escalating it from its side, not the Israelis.
Well, that would make a very different scenario. I mean, I'm just thinking to myself, I'm not an expert in military affairs, but it's really easy to bomb Gaza and kill civilians who are pretty much defenseless. It might be a little different ball game when you go into southern Lebanon and you have to take on Hezbollah, which is essentially an unofficial army with some 100,000 troops, correct?
That's true, actually. I mean, look at it this way. For the past 8 months, we've lost about 400 martyrs, including 320 martyrs that are Hezbollah fighters and other resistance groups from Amal Movement, SSMP, and others. Whereas basically back in 2006, when we had the Israeli aggression on Lebanon in July 2006, basically Hezbollah lost in 34 days 250 fighters. So in 8 months, they actually knew how to play the game. They knew how to deplete the resources of the Israelis and shy away, like basically they are doing the hit and run kind of fight, the guerrilla warfare, that the Israelis can't even find them where they are.
So why would Israel want to do this at a time when the world is watching them, at a time when the world is criticizing them, when they have their hands full in Gaza? Why would Israel, and I've read what they've said, I just started reading Benny Gantz and all these guys, they are firing off the sword and the rattle, and they're saying, we're going there next, and we're going to kill them all, and this is going to be huge. Why would they do that, and why would they say that?
All right, so you have two different groups in Israel at the moment, Netanyahu and his bulk, and Benny Gantz and his bulk. Netanyahu wants a calm and elongated war, like prolonged war, and this is why he prefers the Gaza war, because the longer that war extends, he can stay in power. Remember that his people are basically divided against him. They're rallying against him.
Yes.
Benny Gantz is against him, and he thinks that he's going to be the next prime minister. Benny Gantz is being supported by the Americans since day one. So the whole idea is that, and you see basically in the American media, they're all pressuring Netanyahu. They're all basically blaming him for everything that's happening. Benny Gantz, on the other hand, basically does what the Americans do or ask him to do. And since the beginning of this war until now, the Americans had always wanted to deplete the resources of Hezbollah at one point or another if they want to control the Eastern Mediterranean region, because Hezbollah is the major threat or the main threat to them being there. To control the energy resources in the Eastern Mediterranean, and it's basically floating on an abundant field of gas in their offshore gas.
But I'm going to stop you for a minute because I just think, for me anyway, you made some news here, something we don't often hear in the West, that the United States is more for Benny Gantz than they are for Netanyahu. And further, we could have deduced that, further, they'd like to see Benny Gantz become the prime minister. They find him to be more malleable, and they could use him as a tool to egg on not really Hezbollah, but who they're really after, which is Iran. Am I correct in my assessment?
To a certain degree, yes, you are. I mean, think about it. Who visited Washington in the recent months? Benny Gantz. Netanyahu had to go and kill basically the diplomats in Washington from meeting with him, with Benny Gantz. Benny Gantz, at one point or another, whenever the Americans screamed basically that they want war with Lebanon, he was the one who was actually calling for war with Lebanon, along with those who are clapping for him. We're talking about Halevi and Eisenkot, Gadi Eisenkot, chief of staff and basically other army generals. So if you look at it this way, there is a camp that wants that war with the Northern Front, basically with South Lebanon. And there's a camp that doesn't want it. They want just to focus on Gaza. So the ones who want to focus on Gaza want a prolonged war that keeps them in power. And that's Netanyahu, until he finds a leeway to get himself out of the trouble that he basically buried himself in. For Benny Gantz, they want that war. They actually want the Northern war because the Americans are pushing them to that.
Let me ask you the $64 million question before I let you go, which I think is important because a lot of people, we hear the world talk about this all the time. I know that Hezbollah is not really the army of Lebanon. They're kind of separate. They're their own institution in many ways. But many people would argue, and certainly that's what we hear in our country, in Washington, say that Hezbollah is simply an arm for Iran, that they're nothing more than Iranian soldiers dressed as Hezbollah soldiers. How would you answer that?
Well, I know for a fact because I've been covering them for the past 24 years. I mean, I started covering Lebanon since 2000, since the Israelis withdrew from most of South Lebanon. And this is not true. Actually, the Iranians gave them arms, they give them the funding, but they don't control their internal decision-making. So when, for example, Hezbollah decides this is the day that we want to bombard the Israelis, it's not up to the Iranians to do so. It's up to the Lebanese because they know their front better than anybody else. When it comes to internal politics, it's the same thing. However, you have to understand, under international law, they are a resistance. That's why the United Nations haven't put them on the terrorist list so far. And moreover, you have to remember one thing, that the Lebanese governments, consecutive governments, since 1996 until today, they have adopted a defense strategy that says army, resistance, and people. So they have adopted Hezbollah for the past three decades, saying that it's part of the defense system of Lebanon. So it's kind of like part of that system. And also they have the basically political wing that's part of the government, part of the parliament, and part of the municipalities as well.
Yeah, let's see what happens. We have only 30 seconds left, but would you dare say that this thing will escalate soon beyond what we've seen in the past? Is that your fear, or do you see it happening?
No, I don't fear anything. I covered the 2006 Israeli aggression, but it will escalate, it will prolong, and we will see a very hot summer going forward. Keep your eyes on Lebanon.
Wow. Well, you're a delightful guest. You're so intelligent. You know your region so well. You have unbelievable information that you've shared with us, things I've never heard before, and it's a real delight to have you on as a guest. Thank you so much, Leila. Appreciate your time.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
And that's our show. And always remember to try and look for the truth outside your own box. Truths don't live in boxes. It's kind of how we dedicate our show. That's our mission moving forward. Hopefully it'll be yours as well. I'm Rick Sanchez, and we'll be looking for you right here on Direct Impact.